Case number 21-121 et al. Heating, air conditioning, and refrigeration distributors international et al. Petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency and Michael S. Reagan in his official capacity as administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Worth for the association petitioners, Mr. D'Angelo for the petitioner, the Worthington Inc., Mr. Williamson for the petitioner's choice of grievance, Mr. Coughlin for the respondents.
Mr. Worth, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Stephen Worth for the Association of Petitioners. I'll be addressing EPA's lack of statutory authority to regulate cylinders this morning. My colleague, Mr. D'Angelo, will be addressing our arbitrary and capricious agreements. The AIM Act directs EPA to phase down the production and consumption of hydrofluorocarbons through an allowance allocation and trading program. But Congress did not grant EPA authority to regulate the cylinders used to store and transport HFCs. Indeed, the Act never mentioned cylinders. Instead, EPA bases its entire cylinder regulating regime on two words, shall ensure, found in section E2B of the Act. According to EPA, these two words grant the agency essentially unlimited authority to devise what it calls complementary measures that the agency thinks will help it to enforce the phase down by reducing smuggling. The problem with EPA's interpretation is that section E2B does not grant EPA any power to issue regulations at all. It doesn't say shall by regulation ensure. Unlike all the other places in where Congress has directed EPA to act by issuing regulations, section E2B is different. It includes no rulemaking authority. And that lack of express rulemaking authority is, I think, very important. Because if Congress intended to give EPA broad authority to regulate cylinders to address smuggling, we would expect Congress to confer that power in the section of the Act that expressly grants EPA authority to enforce the phase down. And that's in Section K. Section K is easy to overlook because it operates by incorporating Sections 113 and 114 of the Clean Air Act. But those provisions of the Clean Air Act give EPA extraordinary powers to detect, to interdict, and to punish smuggling, including by requiring advance notice and pre-clearance of all imports, by authorizing EPA to physically inspect records and premises, by granting EPA subpoena powers, and by authorizing EPA to bring administrative, civil, and criminal actions for violations of the AIM Act, with penalties that range from revocation of allowances to civil monetary penalties to jail time. And for decades, EPA has run on those powers in order to combat smuggling of early refrigerant chemicals.
Does the Clean Air Act enforcement authority confer on EPA under the AIM Act authority to impose labeling requirements?
No, I don't believe that it does.
How about batch testing requirements, batch testing of blends, for example?
I don't know off the top of my head, Judge Billy.
Auditing requirements?
Potentially.
The Clean Air Act generally?
Clean Air Act, yes.
How about transshipment rules?
I believe it would as well.
The Clean Air Act general?
I believe so.
K authority. And what about there's some other alternative raised by commenters and cited by the petitioners, things like certifying HFC packaging facilities, authentication programs, that kind of thing you say would be under.
I think all of those under could K. be potentially available under the Clean Air Act, which is incorporated under K, yes.
But no labeling or batch testing. Subsection E2B is about actual consumption, including consumption under the phase down amounts and the allowances, but also any other consumption, right? It talks about annual quantities produced or consumed.
Yes, it does.
And when Congress enacted the AIM Act, presumably it was aware that globally most countries had taken measures to limit HFCs.
Yes, that's right. Right.
And many of the leading markets had also adopted refillable cylinder requirements.
Yes, I think that's meaningful because Congress did not then go to adopt those
right.
requirements.
It could have, but it absolutely could have.
It
didn't.
Could. Yeah. And to be clear, Congress knows how to regulate these cylinders. In fact, Congress has authorized the Department of Transportation specifically to regulate exactly the design of the cylinders in question here. And the cylinders we're talking about, they're called DOT-39s because that's the DOT regulation that governs their design. Everything from the surface.
It's a familiar kind of, cylinder.
Exactly.
So the Congress that enacted this law was aware that there would be significant pressure of illegal marketing into the United States, given what the markets that were closing down in other countries for HFCs, everyone's dealing with potential circumvention.
Well, other markets are, but I think other markets also have different methods of dealing with this type of circumvention. Here, Congress has dealt with that through the enforcement provisions of the Clean Air Act, which do give the EPA really substantial power to interdict smuggling.
So there's enforcement, but the question of sort of separately compliance, anti-circumvention, I don't see that dealt with in this act, in the AIM Act.
Well, so I think there are a couple different ways that it does it. One is it allows you to punish after the fact, right? So you can punish after the fact, but it also does give the agency the authority to require preclearance and notification of all sorts of imports and shipments, and include and EPA in the final rule has in fact adopted measures by which all importers must give 14 days notice to the agency and get preclearance for all of their imports.
So that would be helpful even with illegal importation, I guess, because if something comes in and it looks like HFCs, but it's not something that CBP was given advance warning of,
exactly.
That it would be another way of sort of separating the
exactly,
illegal
that's right.
from the illegal.
Exactly.
So you've not identified any authorization other than the General Clean Air Act enforcement regime for anti-circumvention measures. There just isn't any other provision in.
No, there's not. And I think, you know, that is telling. I think it's because Congress knew that the existing measures that EPA has are in fact quite powerful, and Congress and EPA has used these in the past in order to interdict smuggling of other refrigerants.
Right. And would it have made a difference? I heard you to be suggesting that it might have if E2B had included authority to promulgate regulations.
I think that would make a difference. I think you look at the act, I would ask you all to read the act from top to bottom and just to see how it all hangs together, because I really do think that when you look at how all these provisions fit together, there are many instances where Congress has given the agency very express rulemaking authority to do all manner of things, and E2B doesn't do that.
Just to push back on that, though, Congress conferred regulatory authority under K1A to promulgate regulations to carry out the functions of the administrator.
Absolutely.
And in E2B described one of the administrator's functions to be that he shall ensure that annual quantities produced or consumed not exceed the applicable maxima.
Why these? I think very telling that EPA has expressly disclaimed any reliance on.
I didn't read it quite that way. I read them to say you're talking about the response to comment where they said.
Yes.
You know, we're not relying on K1A for, I took it to be for the substantive, scope of the regulatory authority that they're saying, look, we actually have a compliance, a provision in the AIM Act that's entitled compliance that says we shall ensure that excess is not imported or manufactured or consumed. And so we're not relying on K1A there.
I understand. Judge Henderson, I see my time has expired. May I continue?
Sure.
Yeah. Just to be very clear, putting waiver aside or putting this disclaimer aside, Section K is not a broad grant, the sort of whatever it takes rulemaking authority. It merely authorizes the agency to engage in gap filling to implement aspects of the administrator's authority. And that's how this court treated similar provision of the Clean Air Act in the Alabama Power case. But I really don't think that the agency is relying on broad rulemaking authority in Section K.
No, I take it to be relying on Section K as providing what you pointed out to be the missing language in E2B, that is a duty of the administrator, a function of the administrator expressly under the AIM Act is to ensure that annual quantities produced or consumed don't exceed the applicable maxima. And then that because that's a duty, if the administrator finds it, you know, a reasonable measure that would support that function, that would be clearly within the agency's authority under K1A.
I do want to, however, really talk about this, the use of the word shall ensure here. I think it's really important to understand how Section E2B functions in this regulatory scheme, in the statutory scheme. So Section E2B, I think, serves two roles. And the first and most important role is that this is the only section of the Act that sets out the aggregate production and consumption volume for all regulated substances under the Act and specifically describes how to calculate it by multiplying production consumption baselines by these declining percentages per year. And the resulting curve that you get from making those calculations, that is the phase down. That really is the core of the Act. And this is the only section of the Act that actually describes it. As for the shall ensure language, I think what that language clarifies is the primacy of the declining phase out curve as a condition on all of the specific regulatory actions that the statute directs or authorizes EPA to take. So in other words, EPA's obligation to ensure that the aggregate production and consumption baselines are not exceeded is a condition on EPA's authority as it carries out all of its other assigned responsibilities under the statute.
Right, so this is your words of constraint versus authorization argument.
That's right.
Yeah. So ensure there only means to make certain that other authorities are not seen to trump the core phase down authority. It doesn't give any other compliance authority.
Yes. And I think that's especially demonstrated in all of the cross-references to Section E2B that you see throughout the Act. Every time E2B is referenced, it is as a constraint on the agency's authority. It is not an affirmative grant.
I didn't entirely follow that. It's not a constraint on the EPA's authority. It is putting a duty on the agency to act, which is what the Act, generally the AIM Act, is doing. It's putting a duty on the agency to constrain the market, to constrain the actor subject to the regulation. So the idea that it limits EPA, I just find that sort of hard to follow.
So I think we are talking a little about the same thing here. If you look at section, for example, Section E2D Romanet 1, this is where Congress has told the agency you need to do this through granting allowances. And it says, you know, it tells EPA you have to grant allowances in conformity with this phase now. And what it's saying is you can't grant more allowances than we've authorized under the phase.
Right. And similarly, E5B Romanet 3 mm-hmm. authorizes EPA to allow export-oriented production in excess of a person's allowances, but only if it wouldn't violate
yes.
E2B. So it's sort of if we're ahead of schedule, if things are going really well and there's some reservoir, then you could grant more export-oriented production, but not otherwise. And similarly with...
And I think the violation language there is notable, because if this were a grant of authority, it would be strange to talk about violating E2B, right? It would be strange to talk, if this was a grant of, on EPA, it would be strange to talk about a violation. And the same goes for section, J3. And that's, I think that's important because it creates an exception to E2B. And again, you know, this is a kind of exception proves the rule situation. By expressly authorizing EPA to deviate from its duty under E2B, that proves that the section is conditioning EPA's authority. It's not sort of conferring more of.
Well, it's reconciling the different yes. provisions. But I guess what's not clear to me is why, if that's the only function of the shall ensure, it it doesn't say that, because given K and given that it's the only compliance provision in the act, it seems like maybe that's a plausible reading, but it's not the reading that the agency here took, and Congress does not clearly limit its function in that way.
Well, I mean,
it's a clever argument, and I think I really do follow it, but I'm not sure that it goes as far as implying that E2B is a limitation.
I understand that, and I think that sort of draws us back into my prior arguments, which is to say, Congress did give express rulemaking authority in all these other places, and it did give the agency enforcement authority in section K. And so it's those expressed grants of authority, and that's what really matters here. Congress gave EPA tools to deal with these issues, and EPA needs to use those tools. It's not able to simply conjure compliance methods out of thin air. And again, just maybe push a little bit further on my textual argument with respect to the shall ensure language. And this is how the Act has used that language. Every time it uses the word ensure, it uses the word ensure three times. Every time, it's not a grant of authority. It is a condition on the agency. It is a duty on the agency. It doesn't give it broader authority than otherwise grant.
Again, it's a duty, and it's a duty to act consistent with that stated.
Yes, that's right. I've gone way over my time.
All right, we'll give you. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think just one question. I look at E2B, it looks like a math formula.
Yes.
It looks like it's telling the agency, you need to use this math formula.
Absolutely.
No more, no less. You agree?
I agree.
Is the government? Okay.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Mr. D'Angelo.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Wayne D'Angelo, Commissioner of Worthington Industries. Your Honors, even if EPA did possess the authority it claims, this Court should still set aside the cylinder ban. Banning non-refillable cylinders is not rationally connected to the one and only reason EPA claims to have promulgated this ban, and that is to address HFC smuggling. EPA's final rule and brief, they disclaim quite a few times that it banned non-refillable cylinders to address refrigerant smuggling. There's a reason why they do so, of course, and I think it helps understand the rulemaking and why there appears to be such a mismatch in the record between the rationale and the record. When EPA proposed the cylinder ban, justification was much more about emissions from the venting of residual gases that remain at the bottom of the cylinder, called HEALs, so HEAL venting. That's why so much of the rulemaking record and nearly all of EPA's analysis is focused on HEAL venting rather than smuggling. It's why the discussion of the connection between cylinder bans and smuggling, based on a memo that EPA drafted and added to the docket 2 weeks before finalizing the rule. It's also why the presumed reduction in HEAL emissions are the only benefits EPA calculated in the regulatory impact analysis, and they are massive. 30 million metric tons of emissions reductions attributable to HEAL venting alone, zero attributable to smuggling. Billions of dollars of social benefits from HEAL. Eliminating HEAL venting and zero from smuggling prevention. The regulatory impact analysis is 50 pages talking about the cylinder ban, all of it talking about venting. Smuggling comes in on the very last line, says, as noted in the preamble, the provision is an important compliance tool. This looks like a record for an anti-venting prohibition. But the final rule is clear, Your Honors, because EPA says venting of HEALs was not, quote, a part of the fundamental rationale or related to the authority upon which EPA is relying. And the question is, why be so emphatic about narrowing your justification for the cylinder ban? I think the answer relates to what Mr. Worth was talking about from the statutory side. The flaw is, we believe the government's statutory construction may be, even EPA's interpretation of E2B can't construe cylinder venting prohibition as within its claimed authority to enforce the AIM Act's production and consumption limits. But this left EPA with just square pegs and round holes, a mismatch between the record that it established.
Why isn't it consumption limits?
Because consumption is not defined to include venting from
throwing away.
Yeah. And EPA does not suggest it. So that's why we have a mismatch with the rule. And I'll describe a couple ways that that sort of plays out. For one, it's utterly inconceivable that EPA could look at the European Union cylinder ban and pull that out as an example of why we believe banning non-refillable cylinders has a proven track record of success, quoting the agency there. EU is a model not to be emulated. It is a model to be avoided. And there's reasons for this. The EU cylinder ban was not intended to address smuggling because it was never intended to address smuggling. EU banned non-refillable cylinders in 2007 for the purposes of prohibiting venting. And all of the records that EPA can cite to an administrative record, they're all showing rampant smuggling, a massive thriving black market. EPA suggests that banning non-refillable cylinders will be an effective anti-smuggling tool because, they provide an easy mechanism for the flagging of illegal HSC activity on the border. But this is not the case, and we saw this has not been the case in the EU because EPA's cylinder ban bans the use of non-refillable cylinders for the 18 regulated substances under the AIM Act. So at the border, there's a perfectly legal reason why a customs agent would see non-refillable cylinders coming in, and refillable cylinders coming in. It is not a means of discerning at all whether that there's an illegal substance in there. The customs still
because has other them. Substances are in disposable cylinders. Is that correct? Is that your point?
Yes,
absolutely. But they would presumably have to be labeled correctly, and it is a big enforcement tool. If they were labeled incorrectly, it raises the likelihood that there could be enforcement. And absolutely. If they're labeled correctly, then it's easy to distinguish.
But none of that has to do with the cylinder design, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't it? I mean, if it's easy to see what's there, you know, and you're, I mean, it's just a heuristic. You're seeing masses of things coming in.
Yeah.
Piece of information that's useful and has been not fail-safe in other countries, but actually useful in this very respect in other countries, according to this record.
Your Honor, I don't see that in the record at all, because in fact, it is not just the other substances that come in non-refillable cylinders, it's other refrigerants as well. It will always be the case in order to determine that cylinder and the substance in it are legal, one would need to look at the substances on the inside. So a customs agent would have to either check the label to see, is this among the 18 or the hundreds of other refrigerants that are on the market or adhesives or helium or otherwise. And in some cases, they would need to test, because that is another obvious way of circumventing that they would just have a label that does not accurately identify what is in the cylinder. So looking at a cylinder doesn't tell you anything about whether that is a legal import or an illegal import.
But looking at a cylinder together with a label is very, very helpful, no?
Well, because the label is what is providing the visual cue to the customs. And Your Honor, even if there was a suggestion that or a reasonable basis by which EPA could say that banning non-refillable cylinders will provide the visual clue. There's evidence in the record that says it was so easily circumvented by smugglers who just would, if they thought they were drawing an enforcement scrutiny based on the use of non-refillable cylinders, would use refillable cylinders. The high value of the refrigerant makes it no barrier at all. That's the quote, no barrier at all to switching to real refillable cylinders.
There's also evidence that it does, in fact, deter smuggling because it's heavier and harder, and the value of them would then have to go back overseas. I mean, part of what Congress was about here was encouraging a domestic market, and certainly the refillable cylinders is an anti-smuggling from major producers overseas and focusing on legal production.
Yes,
domestically.
Sure. So what the record shows, this Cooling Post article, it shows that those the refillable cylinders are not being used as refillable. They're one way. The smuggling transaction is still a one-way transaction. Smugglers are not setting up refillable return and refilling program. So that's why it's no more traceable.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting. I just had a couple of questions I wanted to make sure to ask. There's part of your argument is that the EPA can't rely on personal communications or has to place them in the record. And EPA relies on Sierra Club versus COSL, which requires only that the agency summarize in the record the significant points that it's learned during oral communications, if they're of central relevance to the rulemaking. And it seems to me that EPA has done that here. So is there a reason that the COSL standard is no longer applicable, or that is inadequate, the summarizing of the conclusions of the oral communications that it had with Australia and others?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So there's two responses to that. One, EPA bases this on conversations with the counterparts of the five jurisdictions that have banned non-refillable cylinders. There's not even a citation to four of them. There's only one citation for Australia, and it's not connected to that statement. All of the other instances, and these are broader than just the instances of just related to, you know, whether there was a reason to believe that banning cylinders have a relationship to smuggling. They are simply the identity of either the person, the way that person works, and the date of that conversation. So that is not no more a summary of that conversation than the caption for this case will be a summary of the holdings for this case. We don't know what was said, what was asked, what was the context, whether they presented the information to EPA in a range, and EPA took something from that. We know EPA, the conclusion EPA drew from it, but there's nothing that can be construed as a summary of any of those communications, and those pervade this entire record.
But those are footnotes to texts that they support. So there actually are statements. I mean, it's more like a case citation in a brief where you make a statement of law, a substantive statement, and then there's the footnote is just the case citation, but that doesn't mean that you haven't actually given the key reasoning or the key proposition that was discussed in the case.
Your Honor, I believe there could, you know, in many cases for these questions, there could be a distinction between what was communicated and the conclusion that was drawn.
Well, that's always true if you don't have a verbatim transcript. I mean, that's why I'm asking about the COSL point, because it seems like the standard is allows some amount of flexibility. And I understand that it means it's harder to scrutinize.
Yeah, we don't know the expertise. We don't know how to weigh that. And in most of these cases, EPA is elevating that information above actual hard data that's submitted by commenters. And that is an unreasonable basis for this rulemaking as well, Your Honor. My time has expired.
Oh, and I know you're talking about arbitrary and capricious and not about the statutory argument, but your client does not object to the QR codes, am I right?
We have not, Your Honor. From a manufacturer's perspective, my client manufactures, stamping a QR code on a cylinder is not burdensome.
And what, so you don't have a position, or do you on the authority for the QR codes?
We don't have a particular position on that. We've not articulated that.
So you think there's no statutory authority
for that? I don't think there's statutory authority for that either.
All right, thank you. We'll give you a couple of times in reply. Mr. Williamson.
All the further it goes. Good morning, may it please the court. David Williamson for RMS of Georgia, which is known as Police Refrigerants, and I'll be talking about whether blends are part of the allowance program and the non-delegation issue. The AIM Act created a cap and trade program to phase out certain chemicals known as HFCs in favor of new chemicals patented by large U.S. chemical companies. Congress specifically listed 18 of those chemicals in a table at subsection C1. That's at addendum 2. This is going to get a little complicated, so if you want to follow along, I think that the addendum, even though it has small type, is quite helpful. Critically for this case, the statute prohibits EPA from listing blends in the table for purposes of the allowance program, purposes of the allowance program only. Despite this explicit listing prohibition, EPA says it can require allowances for blends. EPA is reading the second part of the savings clause at subsection C3E2, refer to that as E2, in a way that upends the first part, the prohibition on adding blends to the table. E2 preserves EPA's authority under the AIM Act, but that begs the question of what authority does EPA have? EPA says that subsection E2, that's at addendum 3, gives it the necessary authority to regulate blends, even if they're not listed on the table. But subsection E2 is the requirement to have an allowance for a regulated substance. And that's a legal duty that Congress legislated, not an authority that Congress delegated to EPA. EPA does have certain authorities under the AIM Act, however, so the reference to authorities in the savings clause makes perfect sense. Chief among those authorities is at subsection I of the statute, which allows EPA to phase out HFCs in particular end uses, such as new refrigerators, new air conditioners. But EPA has to make factual findings in order to invoke that authority, unlike in the allowance program where Congress chose the 18 chemicals that are subject to the trading program. The factors that EPA looks at to use that authority are things like affordability, things like availability of substitutes for the old HFCs, and safety. In fact, some of these substitutes for HFCs are flammable, so that's a problem in your kitchen, in your refrigerator.
Can I ask about the science, which I usually need a lot of help with? When an HFC is, when there's a blend, and the blend includes an HFC, does the HFC have the identical chemical composition that it would have outside of the blend?
Your Honor, there was a lot of sort of sniping back and forth in the briefs on this point, but I don't think that the parties actually disagree on the fundamental scientific tenets. The blend is a blend of two HFCs that comes together in the blend. And it has, the key is that the blend has different physical and performance properties. So there's not a chemistry or a molecular interchange. We've talked about whether this is like a cake, like flour and sugar together.
No, don't do any cooking analogies.
So, well, I have to, the one that I think is the closest is it's like,
it's a what?
Mayonnaise.
That is not so. Please, no. The cooking analogies confused me more than they clarified.
So what about if we think about it as a bag of marbles? There are blue marbles, which are the regulated HFCs, and any other color is not regulated. And you put blue marbles into a bag, and the way I understand the savings provision and the ban on regulating blends is that the EPA cannot require allowances for the volume of the entire bag. It can only require allowances that correspond to the quantity or the volume of the blue marble. And that is the distinction that, to my reading and in the briefing, made sense to me as in the savings clause, allowing EPA to regulate a regulated substance within a blend. So the fact that the blue marbles have been put in a mixed bag doesn't deprive the EPA of authority to regulate the blue marbles, even though they can't list bags of marbles as regulated substances and they can't use an allowance, require that allowances be used for the whole bag quantity.
Yes, Your Honor, I hadn't thought of marbles analogy, but let's use that. That is EPA's interpretation. That is what EPA wants to do. But that approach is inconsistent with the text that Congress actually wrote. What Congress said is there's a list of 18 substances. There can be color of marble. And it said you cannot add blends to that list. The list, the function of the list is to define what chemicals need allowances to be produced or to be imported into the country. So blends can never be on that list.
But I took Judge Pillard's question to be a science question and your question to be a statutory interpretation, or your answer to be a statutory interpretation answer. Just forget what the statute says. Is the marbles, the blue marbles analogy, a good analogy, an accurate analogy, or what's going on?
It's not a good analogy, Your Honor, because I think the bag of marbles is here. That once the marbles are in a bag, it's a different product. And Congress said, do not add that product to the list.
Again, you're kind of like, you're labeling it differently than the EPA labels it, and I get that. Maybe you're right about how to label it or not, but if one of the 18 blends is a blue marble, and you put that blue marble with a bunch of other marbles that are not listed, I said blend, I meant HFC. If one of the HFCs is a blue marble, you put that blue marble in a bag with a bunch of marbles that are not regulated, is that in any way different than putting a regulated HFC in a mixture of other unregulated stuff?
From a chemistry standpoint,
yes.
Perhaps not.
Okay.
But importantly, from a statutory standpoint.
I understand you have your...
I mean, that's helpful. Yes. So let me ask you, on your statutory argument, if there was a blend that's the only contents of which are two or more listed substances, that your position is that cannot be, allowances cannot be required.
The plain text says that...
Yes or no? Yes. I mean,
yes.
It cannot be regulated. Unless it's added to the list. And it is also...
Well, it cannot be added to the list.
Right. Right, I understand.
It cannot be added.
So 100% is regulated substances, but they're mixed. Then EPA lacks authority to regulate that.
Right.
And a blend that is 95% a listed substance and 5% something inert, also not subject to regulation because it is not on the list. It can't be on the list. And it differs from what is on the list.
Not subject to regulation, Your Honor. And EPA is troubled by that, but EPA is assuming the premise that Congress wanted to phase out blends. But there's nothing in the statute that indicates phasing out the blends.
I don't read their reading. I don't understand their reading that way. That Congress is giving credit for blends, if they're using non-listed substances in large part, then it's going to be way cheaper in allowance terms to manufacture a blend than to manufacture something that's old school listed 100% HFC. So
I'm not sure that's the case, Your Honor. The blends are different products. They have different chemical
that position. I understand and register that's your position. So now that I think I understand your statutory position, can you explain again your interpretation of what the tail end of the savings clause speaks to? Because it would seem to say you can still regulate the blue marbles. And I hear you saying, no, not when they're in a blend.
Yes, Your Honor, not for purposes of the trading program. For other authorities, yes. But one has to reconcile the words that Congress chose in the first part of the savings clause, which is do not add blends to that list for purposes of the trading program. They didn't say if EPA's interpretation or their desire to regulate all HFCs and all the blends were the case, I have not been able to figure out why the drafter would not have simply said, don't add blends to the table for any purpose. And then EPA can use its authorities to regulate situations where there are substances within blends. But that's not what Congress said. You cannot reconcile EPA's interpretation with that precise language. And Again, it's a very, if you follow the syllogism, that there's a table, the blends cannot come into that table for purposes of the trading program. All that means is that blends cannot be subject to the allowance program. But there are other authorities in the Act that allow EPA, if it makes certain findings of availability, of safety, of acceptance by local codes, can address those blends in other ways. So it's not that blends entirely escape regulation under the Act.
Let me ask. An HFC within a blend still retains identical chemical characteristics to an unblended HFC.
Said no, that's a fundamental point, is that the chemicals are still identifiable. You use a mass spectrometer, but you can, that's how you figure out what's in any material, a piece of stone, you can figure out what the chemicals are that make it up. But the blend takes on new performance characteristics. You cannot use blends of substances, and people don't manufacture blends just to sort of fit the HFCs into the blends. If there were a situation where that was being done for circumvention purposes, that could be dealt with. But
what if you blend HFCs? Is there a chemical reaction?
There's no chemical reaction, but there is a mixing that allows that substance to act in different ways than its component parts. And that's, I know you don't want me to use the mayonnaise, but I think it's so apt, is that you would not just spread like topped up egg and oil on your sandwich. Mayonnaise is an entirely different substance once it's blended. It's physically a different substance, even though you could, if you had the right equipment and time and energy and money, you could potentially unmix it, but extremely difficult to do it.
Well, I was wondering about this in reading your brief, and I think in your comment you referred to feedstocks, and EPA responded and said, no, we're not really talking here about feedstocks, because if I'm understanding correctly, feedstocks are transformed in when they're used, whereas in a blend, EPA has asserted, and you have not disagreed, that the original regulated substance is still discernible. It has not transformed. So I guess my question is the identification of the regulated substances as feedstocks in any way critical to your position?
Well, the statute doesn't use that term. The term is used generally in an industry in situations that doesn't necessarily require chemical combination, right? Dr. Walker is going to hate me for this, but in mayonnaise, you could say the feedstocks of mayonnaise are eggs and oil. It doesn't, that term itself, I've never understood that term to require a chemical reaction. And in the industry, I think it is.
Is the emulsification is not a chemical reaction?
No, it's not in mayonnaise. I don't believe. But Your Honor, I want to emphasize, touching on this, because you're focused on it, these chemicals are given different, what we call ASHRAE numbers. They are different chemicals. In fact, in order to produce and manufacture one of these blends and put it into an air conditioner, one has to approach EPA under 608 of the Clean Air Act regulations and actually get approval, because they need to see that that new blend chemical is going to function correctly in the refrigerator and not destroy the refrigerator. So EPA itself treats these as different substances. And I'm not sure the feedstock issue is positive. We did not intend it to be.
We'll give you a couple of minutes in reply.
May I address the non-delegation?
No.
No.
In reply.
Thank you. Thank
you. Mr. Coughlin?
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Andrew Coughlin on behalf of Respondent United States Environmental Protection Agency. With me at Council's table is Karen Bianco from EPA's Office of General Counsel. Your Honors, Congress passed the AIM Act to phase down production and consumption of HFCs.
Can you speak up a little bit? Maybe.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'll try to.
Much better. You might see if you can make them closer to your face. I don't know if that.
How's this? Is that better?
It's way better, but
okay.
You look uncomfortable.
Well, it's all right. I'll manage.
Okay. Raise the podium, too. That might help.
As high as it goes, I'm afraid. Your Honor, Congress passed the AIM Act to phase down consumption and production of HFCs. It delegated to EPA the responsibility to implement those phase down levels. Petitioner's reading of the AIM Act would seriously undermine EPA's authority to carry out its statutory responsibilities. Their statutory arguments are at odds with the AIM Act's text and purpose and should therefore be rejected. I'd like to begin, if I could, by addressing association petitioner statutory arguments, which concern Section E2B of the AIM Act. In that provision, Congress gave EPA a clear command, ensure that phase down limits are achieved. I think that clear command needs to be understood to carry with it authorization to implement actions necessary to carry out the command. Now, EPA knows that when the HFC phase down limits in the AIM Act take effect, that there is going to be an increase in illegal HFC activity in the United States. And EPA knows that that increase in illegal HFCs will jeopardize achievement of the phase down limits in the AIM Act. So in order to carry out its statutory function, EPA adopted measures to identify and to prevent illegal HFCs, thereby ensuring that HFC production and consumption takes place within the framework of allowances that Congress provided. Specifically, and as relevant here, EPA created a container tracking system in order to know if a unit of bulk HFCs in this country actually corresponded to a required allowance. And it also prohibited the use of disposable cylinders because disposable cylinders are going to be the most attractive vector for smuggling because prohibiting the use of disposable cylinders provides a valuable interdiction benefit.
Can you speak to, go ahead.
Go ahead, please. Okay. If we're not with you on E2B, but there's some other part of this statute or maybe even another statute that allows you to do the QR code regulation and the cylinder regulation, what do we do as a court?
Well, I think EPA explicitly relied on its Section E2B authority. If the court disagrees with us on that statutory issue, then I think the appropriate course would be to remand to the agency.
And this is pivoting a little bit, but the cost of the cylinders is debated. I didn't see much or anything about the cost of the QR code. Do you know what the cost is?
There isn't an explicit discussion of costs of the QR code tracking system in the preamble to the final rule. There are materials in the record, the regulatory impact assessment that assess cost of data requirements under this rule, including the QR code tracking system.
What are they?
I don't have off the top of my head, Judge Walker, the exact figures. My recollection is that the total cost of data requirements, once fully phased in, that is including the QR tracking code, would be something on the order of $15 million thereabouts, ballpark, in cost per year on regulated entities. But again, I just want to stress that I'm going off of memory here. And
that's okay. I appreciate it. And if we think cost informs when a major question is triggered, do we separate the QR code cost and the cylinder cost, or do we look at them together?
Well, I think if you're going to do a major questions analysis here, it would be fair to look at the costs separately. I mean, these are different regulatory provisions. They're challenged separately. And I think we and association petitioners agree that they would be severable. If I could step back for a second and perhaps address what's behind this, I mean, I think that to jump to major questions here based on cost would be, I think, a step too far. I mean, if you look at the West Virginia case, for example, you've got costs that are, I think, two or three orders of magnitude greater than the costs here. I think just about every regulation that an agency issues is probably going to have compliance costs that run into the millions of dollars.
I think there was one of the, I think it was NFIB v. Ocean, one of the cases from last term, and the cost there was, I think, single digit billions.
With that, billions with a B?
Billions with a B.
Yeah.
So much less than West Virginia, but enough that the court seemed to think it's expensive enough to trigger, maybe trigger a major question thing. So maybe once you get to billions with a B, you're talking a major question.
We're still well short of that. I think we're...
Well, they say you're at 2 billion on the syllabus.
Well, I think we dispute that cost characterization.
You say you're at 400 million.
In aggregate over the course of, I believe, until 2050. And so on an annual basis, about 22 million a year is the number that the agency came up with on the cylinder ban. But on major questions as well, I mean, I think there are a number of other factors that just aren't present here that are present in those major question cases. This is not an example of the agency discovering some sweeping authority in a dormant statutory provision in a long extant statute. I mean, this is the first rulemaking that EPA has ever done under the AIM Act. I think that places this on a pretty fundamentally different footing. I think even the association petitioners haven't really expressly invoked the major questions doctrine. They've cited some cases, but I don't think they've gone there. I don't think this court should either.
And in terms of, I mean, one of the things they have suppressed on is, as West Virginia referred to it, as whether it's the agency's bread and butter. And the petitioners have said, look, this is, you know, these are Department of Transportation, cylinders, Customs and Border Patrol is really the agency tasked with figuring out how to detect smuggling or illegal importation. How do you respond to this? Is this the bread and butter of EPA to figure out what compliance measures along these lines are going to be helpful?
I found that argument a little bit puzzling, Judge Bullard, because the petitioners have also said that EPA is well equipped to conduct investigations and to root out illegal activity. And I think that's what EPA is saying that it's doing here, in part with this disposable cylinder ban. I mean, the agency knows how to regulate an industrial sector, and it knows, based on the experience of the European Union, that the disposable cylinders are going to be the most attractive vector for smuggling. So I think it's well within EPA's compass to say, look, we've seen what our sister regulators in these other jurisdictions are doing. We've seen how they've used their enforcement authority, and we've seen what tools have been helpful for them. And so we're going to learn from their experience, and we're going to adopt some of those measures as well.
And is there anything about EPA's expertise as an environmental regulator that well equips it for determining the kinds of containers? I mean, I know there are containers in the pesticide area, there are containers in the biofuels area that are regulated and specified by EPA, but I don't know enough about, you know, is what that has to do with and whether, you know, you have any comeback on the notion that this is just not in your wheelhouse.
Well, exactly to your point, Judge Bullard, I mean, I think EPA has extensive experience working with Customs and Border Protection, for example, to interdict supplies of other smuggled substances, pesticides being one example. EPA also knows quite a bit about regulating refrigerants, of which HFCs are one kind. And to address a comment that my friend on the other side made about the availability of other types of disposable cylinders and the fact that that might lead to some confusion that border and sort of undermine the interdiction value of disposable cylinders, I've spoken to the agency about this. And there are chemicals that are transported in disposable cylinders, helium, certain foams, things like that. But the disposable cylinders that are used to transport those are not identical to disposable cylinders that are used to transport refrigerants. That's what we're talking about here. And when it comes to refrigerants, HFCs are the refrigerant that are transported in disposable cylinders. It's not a non-zero number of other refrigerants, but it's, as you put it, Judge Pillard, a very valuable heuristic for somebody who's an inspector at port dealing with massive volumes of freight moving in to be able to separate the sheep from the goats.
Just circling back, in your discussion with Judge Walker, he had asked if E2B doesn't support it, is there no other source? And I wanted to clarify your position on the K1A authority and, you know, brief embraces sort of K1A as the procedural authority and then the function that's assigned to the administrator is the E2B. And I wasn't sure whether you were walking away from that or...
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to clarify that. So EPA relied on Section E2B for substantive authority. Exactly as you put it, Judge Blurt, EPA relied for procedural authority to issue regulations on K1A. So the two provisions work together, but when it comes to EPA's assertion of substantive authority to issue the QR tracking code system and the disposable cylinder ban, it was relying on subsection E2B.
And what about the blank check argument? I mean, we really have to be concerned when something is phrased as generally as it is, shall ensure, I mean, in some sense, the entire act is explaining how the EPA shall ensure that only the requisite phase down quantities are manufactured and consumed. So you have a problem there because there's a lot of specification in the rest of the act. And you're saying, no, that doesn't exhaust what we do. We have other residual authority. What are the limits on that?
Let me make a point about statutory context and then let me offer some additional limiting principles on how we understand Section E2B. So I think that the point about context is a fair one. There are specific grants of authority elsewhere in the AIM Act, and the command in E2B is a general one. And I do think you have to read that general command in light of those specific authorities. But I think EPA's interpretation of Section E2B does that. EPA understands its authority under Section E2B to issue complementary measures that ensure that those specified mechanisms in the AIM Act actually work the way they're intended. So if you have illegal HFCs coming into the domestic market, those are not going to be HFCs for which an allowance is obtained. And the design of the AIM Act is to set up a system of allowances. The AIM Act creates a system of allowances that EPA then phases down over time, thereby lowering the consumption and production levels of HFC in the country. But that phase down of available allowances doesn't actually perform its intended function if you don't have production and consumption actually occurring within the framework of allowances. So EPA is not looking to its E2B authority as a freestanding authority to just do whatever is necessary to ensure it understands that to work in concert with the other more specific authorities that the agency has been provided with under the Act. And I do want to offer a couple of limiting principles in addition to that contextual point, because I think this is important. And the first one I would offer is that Section E2B can't be read in any way to conflict with other provisions of the AIM Act. And I realize that sounds fairly obvious to say it, but let me give you some examples of how that crashes out. So Congress set phase down limits in the AIM Act. Another way of looking at those phase down limits is that Congress specified the allowable amount of HFC production and consumption in given years. And I think EPA could not use its Section E2B authority in a way that had the effect of driving down HFC production and consumption levels further and faster than Congress called for the AIM Act. I think another example is the AIM Act clearly contemplates that there will be international trade in HFCs. In fact, it defines consumption as including importation of HFCs. I don't think that EPA could, for example, ban all imports of HFCs just because that might help it ensure that phase down limits are achieved. I think that would be inconsistent with the statutory scheme.
So you just answered the question I was about to ask, which is, if you're right about E2B, what can EPA not do under E2B? But your answer is, well, they can't do under E2B what they're prohibited from doing by other parts of the statute. Okay. Is there anything else they can't do under your interpretation of E2B?
Well, I'll give you a couple of other guardrails, I think, on the agency's authority under E2B. The second one that I would offer is that E2B allows the agency to ensure that phase down limits are achieved. Now, any measure that EPA implements under E2B has to be justified as a means to that end. It has to have a rationale that survives scrutiny and is actually linked to the statutory end of phasing down HFC. So I think that limits somewhat the scope of what EPA could do. And then, you know, the third limiting principle that I would offer actually comes from K1A. That's the general rulemaking, the procedural rulemaking authority that EPA relies on. And K1A allows the agency to take regulatory action as necessary to fulfill its functions under the Act. We think that that word necessary does do some disciplining of what EPA is able to do. I want to be clear, I don't think necessary in that context means absolutely necessary or indispensable. I don't think any regulation would ever pass that test. But I think necessary in that context means something like well-adapted or reasonably well-suited. So there has to be a fit between what EPA is doing under Section E2B and that function is going under the AIM Act.
The petitioners use as their parade of horribles something you haven't mentioned, which is, I can't remember the exact phrase, but, you know, rail cars and airplanes, can you require they be fitted out in a certain way, or that the rail cars be only of a certain color if they have HFCs in them? I mean, you get the point. What is the principle that limits that? If that would be helpful or necessary in the way you're referring to, it doesn't conflict with anything else, as Judge Walker pointed out, it would be justified as a means. You know, are we only looking at the limits of arbitrary and capricious power, or?
Was it arbitrary and capricious power certainly backstop? I think that the necessary requirement probably does do some work to police some of those extremely far-flung examples, like painting rail cars a certain color. It's a little bit hard, frankly, though, to answer hypotheticals in the abstract like that. I think that's sort of a function of the broad language that Congress used. It's difficult to draw bright lines when the command is as broad as the command in E2B. But what I would say is, if EPA has an extremely compelling record that says that there is a certain means of conveyance that is the preferred vector for smuggling, and in fact, 90% of the smuggled HFCs that it's interdicting are coming over rail. I don't think Congress would have intended, having told EPA to ensure that phase down limits are achieved, that EPA has no regulatory authority to do anything in that area.
Can you respond a little bit to opposing counsel's discussion of the future? I didn't really read the record to include this that much, or the routine, but just explaining why isn't labeling alone enough? Why refillable cylinders? Why isn't QR codes alone enough? Why refillable cylinders?
I think the way that EPA conceived of the measures that it implemented under Section E2B is that they would work in tandem. They can all stand alone, but they complement each other. And I think that the why QR codes, why stickers aren't enough answer is they don't have the same interdiction benefit as the disposable cylinder ban. I think one of the reasons for that is if you can imagine if somebody is going to smuggle, and disposable cylinders are available to them as a means of doing that, all they have to do is slap a sticker on that. That's a lot easier than obtaining a refillable cylinder. So there's an impediment that the refillable cylinders ban imposes on smugglers that I think is important. And if you think about it from the perspective of somebody who's doing an inspection, again, imagine a busy port, there's a lot of cargo, you're having to do inspections on site, you're drilling down where you notice something maybe out of sorts. You're not checking every single canister to make sure that a sticker's on it. Sticker might be on the back of the canister, might be on the bottom of the canister. You're not certainly not scanning every QR code that's on one of those cylinders. And so that ability to do a quick visual inspection, which the disposable cylinder ban does, I think gives you a benefit that you don't get just from those other measures that EPA has implemented under Section E2B.
And just on the record and COSL and whether it's still the case, I think there was a policy or a memorandum relied on in Sierra Club versus COSL. And what I'm talking about is whether EPA can rely on oral communications so long as it summarizes the significant points made in the meaning, and that the footnote in COSL, this footnote 17, describes an EPA memorandum outlining when and how EPA dockets its meetings with interested persons. And I just wondered, is that still in effect? Is that important for your argument that you've adequately documented those important discussions with counterparts in other countries?
Judge Pillard, I'm not familiar with the exact memo that you're referring to. What I can say is that the way EPA documented its discussions with experts in industry and in other countries regarding the utility of disposable cylinders, the availability of refillable cylinders, is consistent with its practices in other regulatory areas. There's nothing out of the norm about what EPA did here. I do want to make one other point, though, because I think part of their objection was to conversations that EPA had not just with its counterparts in other countries, but also with industry experts. This was related to EPA's estimates of how many refillable cylinders would be needed to replace disposable cylinders. And the point I want to make there is those conversations were documented in the record. The subject matter of those conversations was also summarized in a document that was available for public comment and was explicitly referenced to the notice of proposed rulemaking. And so there was certainly an opportunity for the petitioners here to review what EPA got from those conversations and to respond to it. So I don't think there's any sort of procedural foul there by EPA, certainly not to those conversations with industry. The document that I'm referring to is at JA 35, and the reference in the notice of proposed rulemaking is at JA 2113.
If I can move to the non-delegation issue, can you name a limit on EPA's discretion over which companies get the allowances?
Well, Judge Walker, before I get to the merits of the non-delegation argument, I do just want to address exhaustion and waiver.
If you want. I probably agree with you on the exhaustion point. So,
okay.
If you want to move
okay.
to the other.
Well, I'll move then to the non-delegation merits since we all seem to be on the same page here.
I can't speak for my colleagues.
Well, in that case, maybe I should just briefly okay. summarize what our waiver position is. Section 307D7B, which is the applicable judicial review provision here, imposes a mandatory issue exhaustion requirement. This court has held that statutory mandatory issue exhaustion requirements can't be accepted. And the petitioners did not raise their non-delegation argument in comments. Only those objections that are raised with reasonable specificity in comments are properly before the court. It did not raise that. Therefore, the issue is waived here.
But does the exhaustion requirement even apply? The issue is a little bit novel in that the objection is not really to the regulation, it's to the statute. And if the purpose of exhaustion is raising something to give the agency an opportunity to address it, there's nothing the agency can do if the statute contains an unconstitutional delegation. So I haven't seen a case like this saying that exhaustion applies, not just to a constitutional issue, but a constitutional issue trained on the statute, as to which the agency really doesn't have an opportunity to respond. For example, it would be one thing if the statute didn't ensure due process, but the agency could beef up its process, or if there was some First Amendment problem with the statute, but the agency then regulated in a way that was clearly viewpoint neutral. Here, there's really not, it's hard to see the utility of imposing an exhaustion requirement here. And I just don't know if there's authority doing it in a similar situation.
Well, I think three responses to that, Judge Bullard. I think the first thing I'd note is while there are objection is to the constitutionality of the statute. The reason that choice petitioners are in this court right now is because this court has original jurisdiction to hear challenges to actions by the EPA administrator. So they're challenging an action by the EPA administrator, even if their objection sounds on constitutional grounds. That's the first point I would make. The second point that I would make is that I'm not sure it is completely pointless in this context to waive, to the extent this court even could, the exhaustion requirement, because I mean, I'll grant that there's nothing EPA could do if there is a non-delegation problem here, but agencies that administer statutes know something about the statutes that they administer. And if somebody wants to raise a non-delegation problem in comments, it's at least conceivable to me that the agency could respond to that comment and explain to the commenter how the statute works, where the principles lie that PF guide agency discretion, and why there's no non-delegation problem. So it seems at least possible to me that giving the agency the opportunity to respond to a comment might winnow that issue and spare the court from having to decide this constitutional issue in the first place without any sort of record below. And then the third point I'd make, Judge Pillard, and this is perhaps the most important one, I think the first two points are certainly the second one, perhaps academic, because this is a mandatory exhaustion requirement that's in statute. And the authority I give you for the proposition that structural constitutional claims are not subject to some special treatment under a mandatory exhaustion requirement embedded in statute is Fleming v. U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is a case that we cite in our briefs. I believe the reasoning is on all fours here. This court explicitly held that the structural constitutional claim at issue there, which concerned dual level four cause removal protection of an ALJ, did not warrant special treatment because there was a statutory exhaustion requirement that hadn't been satisfied. That issue was not before the court. So turning back to your question, Judge Henderson, perhaps on the merits of the non-delegation question. I mean, I think what non-delegation requires is an intelligible principle. And I think we've got several intelligible principles here that pass muster under the test. And you have here Congress telling the agency what to phase out, HFCs telling them how quickly to phase out those HFCs, telling them what mechanism to use to phase out HFCs, that is the allowance system, telling the agency who to give priority allowances to and who to temporarily insulate from the phase down of the availability of allowances. We think in the statute also telling the agency with some reasonable clarity who to give those allowances to. Now, having said all of that, I think Congress under non-delegation doctrine could certainly leave it to the agency to decide who among the pool of people who use or produce or consume or might reasonably produce or consume HFCs to give remaining allowances to. I think that falls within the scope of allowable agency discretion, certainly within the bounds of constitutional separation of powers.
At least in that universe of allowances, a subset of allowances, there's no limit on EPA's discretion.
Well, I think that there is no congressional guideline on EPA's discretion. I mean, of course, EPA's discretion in this area is going to be bound by general principles of arbitrary and capricious review. And I think, you know, arbitrary and capricious review is a perfectly fine tool to police the kinds of decision making that EPA makes in this area. I think courts are well equipped to determine if EPA
would that break new ground in non-delegation jurisprudence. I mean, it's already the case that almost any delegation passes the current test for a non-delegation inquiry, and then we'd be going even further than that and saying the statute itself needs to have no intelligible principle, at least for this subset of allowances, so long as the APA provides some limits discretion?
No, I don't think that's what you would say in this case, Judge Walker. I think
Can I just get a clarification? Because I may have misread the statute, but I thought that the statute with, and we're talking about the general pool that isn't more specifically, so there's sort of the slush fund and the concern being, I mean, actually, you know, patronage or punitive or random, you know, assignment. But I thought that the statute required EPA to consider historical consumption rates, and that in fact the allocation of the general pool reflects actors in the market.
Certainly, Judge Blair. I mean, when EPA set the consumption and production baselines, and those consumption and production baselines determine how many allowances there are, it looked to historical practices by HFC producers and consumers, and that was how it developed the allowable levels of HFCs. and how it determined how many allowances would be available.
But that you don't take that to also guide the assignments?
The
historical patterns of manufacturing consumption?
That is how EPA elected to allocate allowances, was based on historical patterns of consumption. I don't think that choice was compelled by the statute.
But not also guided? I mean, we're talking about delegation. So we're talking about, is there any intelligible principle that would prevent my slush fund parade of horribles?
Yes. And, you know, I think what we see in the statute, the intelligible principle that we discern, is direction to allocate those allowances to the pool of companies that produce and consume HFCs or might reasonably be assumed to do so. And how you allocate within that pool, I don't think we think is something that the statute speaks to. We think that that's something that EPA did on a reasonable basis here by looking at those into these historical consumption. But to turn back to your point, Judge Walker, I mean, I think to get to not delegation, you have to slice and dice the statute into such small parts before you can find something that you lack an intelligible principle for. And I just don't see that as what the courts use non-delegation doctrine to do. It's really to police at a very high level whether something crosses some separation of powers line. And I think I don't think it would break any new ground to hold that this does not run afoul of that problem. Yeah, I see I'm out of time, Judge Henderson.
Right. Do you have any questions?
Judge Pillar, can I ask
a science
question while you're looking?
Yeah, please.
I think we got to the bottom of, does the chemical composition of the HFC change when it's in a blend? And I think your opposing counsel conceded, no, it does not. You agree with that concession, I think, and you could maybe point me to something in the record that supports it?
Yes, certainly, Judge Walker. I think if you want to see a record site for discussion on this point, I'd refer you to Joint Appendix 1110 and 1112. And the other point I just note, I realize we were sort of distinguishing between scientific questions and statutory questions. What I'd note, though, is that the statute defines regulated substance by reference to the molecular structure of the regulated substance. So the fact that a regulated substance in a blend, we all agree, maintains its molecular structure means it is still a regulated substance, even though it is part of a blend.
Because the 18 or however many listed regulated substances are like H2O and NaCl and CO2.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So I also had a chair collapse under me. I also had a question about the blends and the treatment of blends. At page 32 of your brief, you say, as a practical matter, it may be true that under the approach in the framework rule, the number of allowances required to import the regulated substances within a blend might be equal to the number of allowances that would be required if the blend itself were designated as a regulated substance. And given our discussion of blue marbles in mixed bags, and I just wanted some clarification of what you're referring to there.
So the scenario we're referring to there, to use your example of blue marbles and red marbles in bags, is a blend that consists entirely of blue marbles.
If blue is one regulated substance and red is another regulated substance, also had a question for opposing counsel about that.
And so I think that the difference there would be if you had, let's say, the bag contains blue marbles that are regulated substances and green marbles, which are not regulated substances. So I think what we're saying is the practical effect of not listing a blend means that you don't have any allowance requirement for those green marbles, only for the blue marbles.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Worth, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Judge Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Pillard, I was surprised by the government's answer to your questions about K1A, because that section doesn't really appear at all in their brief, and it is not the basis that they relied on in the final rule. I think, you know, this is, K1A is not general rulemaking authority. Otherwise, why would Congress in many other provisions of the Act specifically require or authorize rulemaking? If all the government needed was K1A to do whatever it wants, it just simply doesn't make sense. And I think, you know, one way to know that this is not the way that K1A operates is with some historical context here. It's helpful to know that this is not a new issue. Smuggling is not a new issue. Prior refrigerants were phased down in the same way. And smuggling was an issue in the same way. And there was extensive enforcement. And Section 301 of the Clean Air Act has the same sort of necessary and proper language. But to my knowledge, there's never been an instance where the EPA has relied on this sort of necessary and proper rulemaking in order to come up with a full new enforcement scheme. And I think that's really telling here.
They do. And I mean, the reason that I identified it as a source is because they do in their brief. I think it's in a footnote, but they do identify the K1A.
Oh, well, maybe I'm sorry, I missed the footnote.
Yeah.
My apologies. But I do think it is important to know this extra context, which is that the Clean Air Act has this exact same necessary and proper language. I think that it is coming from, and it is normally used in order to facilitate the administration of the Act in, you know, sort of more gap-filling ways, not to create a full new enforcement scheme. And I think that's really important. And as, you know, as we've said, I'm sorry, my time has expired. May I have just a moment more?
Just for your benefit, it's page 53, note 14. Subsection K1A does provide EPA with general procedural authority to promulgate the rule, and they're relying on the substantive authority under E2B as the basis for this kind of rule.
I understand. So I think all of that then goes back to all of our arguments why E2B obviously does not give them that authority. But putting that aside, I think the shall ensure language in E2B, it really is not this general reservoir of rulemaking authority for anti-circumvention. Judge Walker, you mentioned the major question doctrine. I don't think that we even need to go that far, because this sort of elephant and mouse hole problem it's there regardless of whether it's a major question or not. The EPA did not hide vast enforcement authority in the words shall ensure. The EPA enforcement authority in other provisions of the Act, and that's where we need to find. That's where EPA needs to find its authority. Finally, I just want to touch up on one thing about the QR code mandate, and that's to say that, you know, even if EPA does have labeling authority under Section 114 of the Clean Air Act, just to be very clear, EPA did not rely on that authority. We don't think that the QR codes are labeling in the sense that it would be covered under the Clean Air Act. But to be very clear, that's not the authority that they're relying on. And I think you'd have to remand the agency on that point if they wanted to try to rely on it. And then just very quickly on arbitrary and capriciousness on the QR code, because my co-counsel is not interested in that issue. I just wanted to say briefly, we put into the record all sorts of ways that the QR code is simply not going to work because these labels are going to get scratched off. They're not going to be able to be visible. There's all sorts of reasons why it's going to be very difficult to work with them for the people who actually have to deal with them on a day-to-day basis. And the EPA's only response was to push back the implementation date and said the agency, quote, the agency will now have more time to develop an appropriate tracking system. Frankly, it was time to develop that system before they issued the rule, not after the rule. So we would hold them to their requirements.
Thank you. All right, thank you. Mr. D'Angelo, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Non-refillable cylinders are not the preferred vector for smuggling, or at least that is misleading. Non-refillable cylinders are the preferred vector for transporting refrigerants and many other things. To say otherwise is to put in an analogy, having no food, Judge Walker. I'm sure there's data that can be shown that people in airports who smuggle drugs in their suitcases are using black suitcases more than any other, right? Because black suitcases are the predominant color for suitcases. Non-refillable cylinders are used by, except for five nations, by 99%
of the people in the refrigerated industry. So it's not a preferred vector. It does not provide a visual cue to push back a little bit on the visual heuristic. We know it doesn't work because the only data in EPA's record from the EU, and it showed it didn't work. And even if a ban on non-refillable cylinders caused customs officials to just start targeting those shipments that they saw in non-refillable cylinders, EPA's record also tells us it is no burden for these smugglers to be able to just switch over to refillable cylinders, right? If going through the airport, customs is pulling over everybody who's pulling a black bag, smugglers are going to start using red bags. That record says that. Also, if a visible cue is helpful, why did EPA eliminate a cylinder based on its function, by a different function, when all they wanted was a different look? EPA never considered any other alternative to make it look different. And when they were presented those options for different looks for cylinders, which government acknowledges that different non-refillable cylinders can differ in look, they were provided those options by Worthington, which is the only domestic manufacturer of refillable and non-refillable cylinders. And they rejected it out of hand without really even engaging with that. Right? I think this takes me back to what I initially talked about as far as the disconnect, the mismatch between the record that the agency had at proposal and the rationale that they singularly relied on at the end. They focused on they banned the cylinder based on its function when the visual distinctions were readily available in many other ways.
Right. So why don't you wind up? You're over your time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you. Mr. Williamson?
Judge Pillar, without offense, I'm troubled by the marble analogy. And I'll say to Judge Walker that I don't think the chemical reaction point is significant to the statute. But if you were to use a marble analogy, think about it as crushing the marbles and then fusing them together so that it was extraordinarily hard to take them apart. I will just say
we don't even need to do the, I mean, I actually think the marbles analogy is, contrary to what you just said, is very helpful to me, but you can throw all the analogies out. The statute lists 18 chemical compounds. A blend does not change the chemical compounds of the agency.
Well, Your Honor, that is correct. It's also correct that it's entirely sensible to only require allowances for the regulated marbles in the bag of marbles. The problem is that that assumes that Congress wanted to regulate the blend. When you work through this, I urge the court, try to reconcile the listing prohibition. It cannot be reconciled with EPA's view of the scope of what's being regulated, no matter how sensible it is that once you assume that blends are regulated, to only require allowances for the regulated marbles, not for the other regulators. But that listing prohibition means something. It means something that Congress said only for the trading program. Why didn't it just say, don't ever list the marbles, but EPA, you can regulate the regulated. I do want to address the delegation and just to say, if the court finds a jurisdictional defect, we will be back. The rule that we're dealing with now only covered 2 years, 2022 and 2023. EPA has just proposed a 2024 and forward for the next 5 years. We are going to raise the delegation in those comments. We don't think there's a fictional bar, but that will be forwarded.
What if their responses to your comments persuade you?
Well, that goes to the point of, Your Honor, what could they possibly say? We're saying that Congress failed to provide any principle to define the most, and opposing counsel described this as slice and dicing, that delegation doesn't work that way. But this is the core issue, at least for my client. Once you have a program to phase out allowances, you dismantle entire sector, who gets the pieces? Now, EPA actually proposed an auction as one of the options for structuring the phase out. So if EPA thought an auction was available to them, then their arguments about, well, the allowances can only go to past participants in the market don't really hold up. But I did want to also, my last point, address Judge Pillard's inquiry about the historical consumption. Your Honor, that the historical consumption data was only used to set the cap. There's no mention of that then when you get to how do you do the phase out. And there was certainly no individualized consideration of historical consumption in that cap setting. It is all aggregated data on total imports. So, thank you.
All right.